Okay, it's a slightly different system today, so I'm sure I'll get tremendously confused here. Tonight I want to finish off by talking about three phases of fragmentation in 20th century architecture. So it's quite a bureaucratic thing to actually discriminate between three phases and put them in little boxes and say there was this one, that one, and then there was the other one, which is essentially what I'm going to do. But what is interesting to me is not so much the discrimination for the sake of being a discrimination, but some of the implications of making it. And that's what I want to try and start to map out this evening. I have to say that this work is in a state of severe incompletion, and that any aspect of incoherence or fracturedness in the presentation has nothing to do with it being a simulation or an analogue of the subject. It's just simply a fault. That's certainly the case there. These three discriminations are easy enough to make, I think. In fact, they're so obvious, they're hardly worth spending a lot of time on arguing why the discrimination has been made. But essentially, this is what I'm going to try to do. The first phase of fragmentation, it seems to me, is derived from the immense elation attendant on the birth of modern painting. It derives from an understanding of cubism and an attempt to somehow import that into architecture, taking something of this immense elation, this fantastic revolution that has occurred in this other medium, and importing it into our own. But there are very, very peculiar aspects of this, which I'll go into as we go on. Then there's another aspect of the whole phenomenon, which seems to be born from an entirely different circumstance, entirely disconnected to cubism and the history of 20th century art, which seems to relate to a particular idea about the way buildings and, indeed, human society itself relate to one another. It's an idea about function. It's an idea about the humanizing of architecture, which takes over at this point. It's another reason for breaking things up. But they're broken up in a very different way. And they seem to belong, on the surface, to a completely different history of 20th century architecture, with completely different people populating that history. Then there is, aspects of this humanizing of the overly rational aspects of the 20th century effort in architecture are still with us. That is by no means a dead duck. The third of these divisions, is the more recent one over the past two decades, where we see an attempt to to use the language that is employed to describe what's going on in this third phase, to decenter the subject, to sort of fragment reality because already the culture we occupy is fragmented, to actually take to dehumanize architecture because of a need for representation to have some correspondence to reality in some kind of odd way. So this seems to be very much at odds with that middle discrimination. So we have two peculiarities in this last phase. One, it's inimical character to the mainstream of later modernism with its emphasis on humanization. Secondly, a very ambivalent attitude to what its own origins are and what it's relating to. And this I want to come back to again. In the end, I also want to make a few comments about the relationship between what's going on now and what I was talking about yesterday. No, I can't use this anymore, can I? Can I have the slides? Thank you. I want to start off with something that Jean-François Lyotard says in his book On the Postmodern Condition. There he's trying to characterize the difference between the modern and the postmodern. He does it by a comparison. He says Richard Meyer's Athenaeum project, for example, is typical of the modern effort. And the modern effort is characterized by fragmentation. The postmodern effort, by contrast, is not fragmentary. It's essay-like. And his citation as an example of the postmodern is the 16th century French essayist Montaigne, which might seem an odd choice because it's somewhat remote from the present. But this thing is, as a great deal of Lyotard's writing, done with a kind of tongue-in-cheek attitude and a peculiar ambivalence. For all of that, however, we might look at the project that he cites as an instance of the modern with its preoccupation with fragmentation and wonder why it is that if there is such a shift discernible by him towards the postmodern, if it's such a cultural category, if it's such a generalization, why there isn't some architectural version of the essay-like structure, whatever that might be in architecture. Because if one thing is very, very evident, it's that in this period that is normally characterized as postmodern, what happens in architecture is more fragmentation, not less, is it not? This seems perfectly self-evident. All those things which sit within the slightly latter-day notion of the postmodern. There are two versions of it, aren't there? I mean, there's the first one invented by Charles Jenks, which is about a sort of eclecticism of some sort. And then there's this latter-day one, which is a sort of cultural avant-garde issue, and that's the one that I wish to address. Next slide, please. Right. Yeah, this is going to be very difficult because I use the slides to jog my memory, so this isn't going to work tonight. What we're going to be talking about, I mean, we ought to make a discrimination here. We talk about fragmentation, but it's perfectly self-evident that nothing that we're going to be looking at has ever been broken, okay? Nothing. We're talking about things that look as if they've been broken. Now, this raises a certain skepticism about the whole issue of making this discrimination in the first place. Why talk about fragmentation if you can't be literal about it? But in fact, as I'll try to show, the whole issue arises out of this this distancing from the actual breakage. Because then we're having to discriminate about what it is that we intimate to have been broken, because nothing actually has. Is it just our expectations that have been ruptured somewhere along the line, if it's not an actual thing? And if it's our expectations, how does that operate? Next slide, please. Now, what I want to do first is talk about the connection between cubism and architecture. And in order to do that, I think it's probably best to start with one of the earliest detailed accounts of that connection between painting and architecture. And that occurs in Gideon's Space, Time and Architecture, which was published in 1941. And in the body of that book, there is a very noticeable comparison made with two contrasted plates, one on one side, one on the other side of the book, so you can see them tête-à-tête. And these two are basis of a discrimination that Gideon makes of three things which are similar in this painting by Picasso, done in 1911, La Lucienne. Next slide. And the workshop wing of the Bauhaus of 1926 by Gropius, of course. Now, this comparison, I think, brings out some very interesting characteristics of the translation between one and the other. This is where we get away. Can we have the last slide again, please? These three things are as follows. The first similarity is that if you look at the Picasso painting, you see that it's made out of these planar elements. And if you look at the Bauhaus workshop wing, you can see that that also is made out of these planar elements of the concrete floors, which constitute the thing. So this is an element of similarity, says Gideon. Okay, and that seems fair enough. A second level of similarity, says Gideon, is that these planar facets are construed in such a way in this thing as to look almost like glass, that they are transparent, and that therefore this is also a property which is shared with the Bauhaus workshop wing because it has this glass curtain wall and you can see right through it from one side to the other. So this is also a property shared between the painting and the building. And one might say at this point, before going on to the third part of the comparison, that Gideon was already convinced and had already made strenuous efforts to convince his readers that history was on his side here and that it was inevitable that the arts and the sciences, painting and architecture, should have an underlying unity to them. So his effort in all these instances is to simply identify what he knew always to be there. It had to be there. That was part of the, his background in Hegelian German history. So he was simply identifying what was inevitably present. The third element of this comparison is perhaps the most important, but it's actually very dependent on the other two. He says this is simultaneity, planarity, transparency, and simultaneity. Simultaneity, he says, is evident in this thing here because you can see this figure, this this woman's head, in full face and in profile simultaneously. So this is the principle of simultaneity as it occurs in Cubist painting. Now that actually is a favoured explanation, had become a very popular explanation of what was at the basis of Cubism. It was an explanation, as we'll see, which was favoured also by the earlier perpetrators of Cubism itself, although they latterly got rather kind of ambiguous and vague about it. But in the earlier period of its development, this was an idea that was mooted again and again and again. It hangs around Cubism for many years. So that also seems perfectly legitimate in terms of what is already known. Next slide, again. And in terms of the Bauhaus workshop wing, we can see through the building from one side, we can see the front and the side, as well as the underside of all the interiors of the rooms simultaneously. So this is also the principle of simultaneity in the building. So here we have these three identical attributes applicable to these two very different things. Now, one thing that we might notice here is that he never says anything about fragmentation. That is, that fragmentation is not in this comparison. It's been phased out. It just simply doesn't exist. And in fact, one would say, far from being more fragmentary, his description of, and in fact the phenomenon of, the Bauhaus workshop wing works in quite the opposite direction. It is thoroughly unifying. If you can see all parts of the same thing at once without moving, without it being broken, without it being distributed differently, then this thing must be considered far more unified as a presentation than, say, a 19th century house with its numerous rooms, which you have to pass through one to another before you can get a perception of the totality. So there's a peculiar inversion going on here as well. Next slide. Now, this suppression of the idea of... one other thing about this thing. This notion of simultaneity was taken up by Gideon in several other guises, like this one I'm just going to talk about. But he makes another connection with it, because we know also that 20th century science and 20th century art have to be connected. That he says it is it's extremely significant, he says, in a rather kind of portentous way, that in 1905, a book by Einstein himself, on electromechanics, starts off with a discussion of this very issue of simultaneity. And here we have this spectre, this numinous thing about the fourth dimension, Einstein, and non-Euclidean space creeping in by inference into the text. Now, in fact, what he doesn't scruple to tell the reader, maybe what he didn't know, although I suspect he did, was that what Einstein does in that text is to raise the issue of simultaneity in order to present it as an inadequate concept, as something that is inapplicable to relativistic physics. This casts a somewhat different light on it than Gideon was suggesting in the text here. But for all the gullibility or even duplicity of Gideon in making this pompous comparison, that shouldn't blind us to the intelligence of the rest of the comparison, which actually I think is very, very well chosen. That he comes back later in the book to this idea of simultaneity and presents it again, this idea of being seen in different aspects simultaneously, in a completely different guise. And it is tremendously interesting that what he does is he takes this compilation here, which was done in 1932 by Thurman Rotan, and he redoes it. Next slide, please. To show the Rockefeller Center with 11 different photographs collaged together in this way, in order to intimate something of the mosaic effect of perception of the city. One can't see this thing, which you might notice, is hardly transparent and hardly planar, but has very different properties. You can't see this thing simultaneously, so you have to kind of round it one part after another. And memory, as it were, reconstructs the totality of the object by this process of reconstitution of the parts. Now, again, this seems like almost a very, very literal illustration of this idea about cubist painting that lurks around it in the early teens. But the thing that is very striking about it is that in order to illustrate the unity of total perception, you have to break the thing. Now that is, it seems to me, a very interesting thing, and it's actually a principle. If you want to get the totality of a three-dimensional thing in a two-dimensional plane, you have to violate it somehow, don't you? This is obvious. Next. Right. Now, let's leave architecture, the architectural comparison there for a minute, and just go and see what the Cubist painters themselves were doing, because this is interesting in another light in relation to the architectural enterprise, peculiarly enough. When the architectural critic, Gellert Burgess, went to Paris in 1908, he returned to America and published a largely satirical account of new developments in new painting in France. It's a very, very interesting article. It occurs in the Architectural Record of 1910. The Wild Men of Paris, it's called. Two things happen there. First, I want to do this, and I just want you to bear this in mind for the end of the lecture, right? This is just what it says in there. A party of well-dressed Parisians in a paroxysm of merriment, gazing through weeping eyes at a picture. Even in my haste, I had noticed other spectators lurching hysterically in and out of the galleries. I had caught sight of paintings that had made me gasp, but here I stopped in amazement. It was a thing to startle even Paris. I realized for the first time that my views on art needed a radical reconstruction. Suddenly I had entered a new world, a universe of ugliness, and so on and so forth. I mean, it's one of the satirical account. But that idea, you know, this thing of people laughing, of reeling about, laughing hysterically at these paintings, that actually happened. That actually happened, day in, day out. That was the response to this work. We have to remember that. We have to remember the kind of reception that this thing actually obtained at its inception. Now, and many people repeat that as well. It's not just kind of Burgess, including some of the painters, who then, as a response to that, start making jokes in the painting. The painting become jokes. Even the very first of them, Demoiselle d'Avignon, was conceived of as a hilarious joke about putting people in a brothel and breaking them all up and putting their grandmothers in and all sorts of things. So you see, we have this kind of very strange attitude to this this new phenomenon. It's not serious at the point at which it first comes to being. Secondly, He goes on to describe his meetings with these various artists, and a very, very lovely description of his meeting with Braque, Georges Braque. And he goes into Braque's studio, and there's this kind of languid man, an enormous fellow, sort of in the studio saying this and that. And he asks him what it is that animates him, what is it that makes him do this work. And then Braque says, I'm trying to paint not the adventitious woman, but the essential woman. I'm trying, when I paint a female nude, that's what I want. Nothing about what we appear, not appearance, is nothing to do with it. And he said, in order to do this, I have to paint three women. One from the front, one from the side, and one from the top. Just like an architect, he says, draws plans. Now, this might have been prompted by the fact that he knew that Burgess was an architectural critic. But it's not, again, it's not an isolated statement. He gives the incredulous Burgess this little drawing here to illustrate the principle he's just announced. Next slide. Picasso, not one to make statements about what his work is about at any time, also says, as an explanation of one of his female nudes, that it's a bit like a projection of a map. That if you took all the bits that he painted on the surface of the canvas, he said, cut them out and stuck them together, you'd get the woman again. Now that's a very similar idea, that you have all these pieces, and that by some kind of reconstitution, like kind of Mercator's projection of the human body, you would reconstitute the three-dimensional embodiment that it had arisen from. But the totality was somehow there on the canvas. And then this is a portrait of Kahnweiler. Kahnweiler writes on the development of cubism, says in 1919, a little later, he says that the pictorial method invented by the cubists made it possible to get rid of all the endemic distortion in Western art. What they were apparently after in this early phase was an idea of getting rid of the distortion in art, making it more real, not less, but in a very special way. And this is, again, the quote from Kahnweiler. With the representation of solid objects, this could be effected by a process of representation that has a certain resemblance to geometrical drawing. This is a matter of course, since the aim of both is to render the three-dimensional object on a two-dimensional plane. In addition, the painter no longer has to limit himself to depicting the object as it would appear from one given viewpoint, but wherever necessary for fuller comprehension, can show it from several sides and from above and from below. So you see it's a very similar kind of thing. Next slide, please. And they had also an actuary who was their mathematical advisor, some of these painters in the Puteau group, one recent writer who's been doing a wonderful study of this, Dalrymple Henderson, has unearthed these diagrams by a mathematician from the late 19th century, Esprit Giffré, showing four-dimensional solids on a two-dimensional plane. And again, even more than with the transfer from three to two dimensions, you need many, many different things, as it were, flattened onto this sheet in order to show the total object. And Dalrymple Henderson, next slide please, shows quite clearly that these become actually illustrative elements in some paintings, like this one of Le Fauconnier, where you can see the child holding one of these things there, straight out of Giffré, and there's another one somewhere around. I think there it is, looks hanging around on the ground. So these things become kind of illustrative pieces. Well, I mean, in a way that's trivial. But it's evidence. Next, please. And it is certainly true that most critics of cubism, most commentators on cubism in the present time, express a considerable scepticism about this early explanation of what cubism was all about. They say that you can look from one end of cubism to the other and not find any actual representation that is conducted that way in a serious or methodical way, and that is certainly true. But one thing I'd like to point out here is, A, whether they actually do it or not, and this is André Lhote in 1955 trying to explain to somebody who's asking him questions about the nature of cubism what this technique is. And he's very doctrinaire about this proposition of showing each facet of reality on a single sheet by having a faceted vision. But even he only makes a kind of vague stab at making it rigorous. It's not really, it's a sort of compositional thing in the end. Next slide. And the only actual clear representation of this type has nothing to do with cubism at all. But that's the only one I've been able to find in there. In a book on portraiture by Jean Cousin, published in 1608, where, for reasons which are not entirely clear in the text, he simply does, literally, an elevation and a frontal elevation of a human face simultaneously. But this is the thing that you will never find so explicitly in cubism. Now, we have this skepticism then. Two things I'd like to bring out here. Firstly, that in these early years, nobody in cubism says anything about the fractured nature of the work. That's not what they see. Actually, they seem to see exactly the opposite. They see it as a synthesizing, unifying, totalizing procedure, not one of fragmentation at all. They talk of it as scientific, analytical, in relation to geometry, all these ratifying things that are going on. What it's actually like, of course, is another question, and we might be right, looking at it in retrospect, seeing in it all this fragmentation. But the point I'm trying to make is that they either didn't see it, which is extremely hard to believe, or were very insistent on not making any mention of it in relation to the work, because it was a sort of adventitious byproduct of what they saw as a unifying, constitutive vision. Next, please. Sorry. Their explanation for this technique and their explanation for going over to architects' ways of drawings and engineers' ways of drawing was because of their hatred, their animosity towards one thing, which was perspective. They saw perspective as the confining vision of classical European art. They wanted to get rid of it. Everybody within that movement says so. It's something that you come across in every piece of criticism that's addressed this subject. The animosity is so considerable that they will do anything to get rid of this pictorial convention. What do they say about this thing? They say, well, it's not really how we see, it's just a convention. B, it's also a distortion. Perspective is a distortion of the truth. Now, you see, we get back to an idea about what's true. They're trying to actually import back into painting something much more coherently real than was ever there before. At least if you look at it in one certain way, that is the cubist effort in these early years. They want more reality, not less, more realism of an essential kind of tangible kind almost. And this flattening out of the object, this capturing it in the plane of the surface is a way of doing that. The other thing they say about perspective is that it's Euclidean, which is nonsense, actually. But what that enabled them to do was to see what they were doing as somehow non-Euclidean and therefore parallel with developments in 19th century mathematics, which had done away with all these axioms and assumptions, which proved to be quite wrong. So they saw their own exploration is in many ways similar or identical to that of mathematicians like Bolyai, Lobachevsky, and Riemann, who had revolutionized the axioms of geometry during the 19th century period. Next. The other thing which I think is worth mentioning here is when we see the fragmentation in these pictures, what we're seeing as being fragmented. There are plenty of pictures which have got lots of fragmentation in before cubism. There's battle scenes, there's natural disasters, there's pictures of hell, all sorts of stuff, like this one by Friedrich of an ice flow in the 1830s. Next slide. But the thing about these highly sublime, you know, enormous events, fractures of real things, is that they're seen in an unfractured space. What is, I think, very interesting in comparison, say, with this little Brach mandolin here from 1909, apart from the difference in the actual size of the paintings, is the shift over to this domestic, very ordinary, completely unsublime content of the thing. Just a mandolin sitting on a table, probably, or somewhere as part of a still life. Completely unambiguous, tiny little frame pictures, painted in a quite conventional way, and yet what's happened is that because of all these conformities, you can't any longer believe that what you're looking at is broken in itself. Something between you and it has been broken, and here we have the other aspect of this new vision, that it seems to have been fracturing the space between you and the thing. So it's not about the object anymore. It's about the very process of perception and vision. That also is a commonplace, but it's probably worth pointing out in relation to these things. Next, please. Now, in terms of this belated recognition of the presence of fragmentation in Cubism, it seems to me very important, this sublimation that occurs both in painting and even more effectively in the translation from painting to architecture. Eunice Lipton says that it was only in the 1930s that Picasso critics began to identify fragmentation in these works. And it's very interesting, I think, that she says that the reason for that was because of the Spanish tragedy. In other words, what they were unable to do in this final moment between 36 and 39 was to see this fragmentary character of the work and the obviously tragic character of the events that were seemingly intimated by it as referencing to the political situation of Spain. That enabled them to actually identify this fractured and disrupted format of the work. But until then, nobody had actually made anything of it much, and the few people who did, it was only as a form of criticism of what Cubism was doing. That was the worst aspect of it. Next. So, having gone through this process, having seen that there is something else in Cubism according to its own early lights than what we see back in it, isn't to say that what we see in it is wrong. Ours might be the superior vision. That's not clear at all. I don't want to even bother to comment on that because it's a much wider subject. What is interesting to me is the sublimation of that idea in the early work, although it seems so obvious to us now. Not even the idea of its ambiguity is made anything of in that period either. So we see that they're looking at it in a very different light. Now, what happens when this stuff, which we see as so fractured and dismembered, this dismembered corpse of the tortured body of perspective, bashed around, pulled about, and reconstituted in the painting? What happens when that starts to jump back out of the canvas again? This is, of course, a question which relates to, so to say, Cubist sculpture, and it relates to architecture. And the first intimations of that are in these very well-known works around 1912, when Picasso and Brach start to put real things into the painting and start to get the painting to jump out into the real world again. Next slide. And in 1912, Picasso is doing things like this guitar maquette, which, for all their apparent naivety, I think in comparison with practically anything else that's done in the next few years, have quite astonishing similarities to the paintings. I mean, the first thing is, of course, it's three-dimensional again, but it's still not a guitar. It's all busted up, that we might expect, but it's the way in which it still maintains some of these unstated characteristics of the Cubist enterprise in it, in this re-embodied state. Now compare that to the next slide, please. To the Maison Cubiste by Duchamp, Villon, which was done in 1912 as well, and it's the first essay from the Cubists themselves in Cubist architecture, and Duchamp-Villon became a sort of an expositor of Cubist architecture for a few years, the man from the movement, who, as it were, did all these projects to show what Cubist architecture would actually be like. And here we see the problem, don't we? I mean, it is immediately evident that when one makes a thing like this, it looks like the paintings. That is, that it reminds us of the painting. But what other properties of the painting travel into the object are obviously to be discussed. That is, it isn't ambiguity. It's totally unambiguous in its form. Next slide. This shows you the elevation of the same scheme. And it shows also, in comparison to this extraordinary revolutionary effort in painting, what has happened to this now decorative art applied to just exactly the parts of a house that you'd expect to be decorated in any event when that happens. So that, in fact, we just looked at the portal of that in the larger photograph. So clearly here we have a problem, which is simply that in the first enthusiasm of translation, this thing simply turns into the nearest equivalent in stone to what appears to be the cubist object. But here again, it's never stated, but of course what he's working with is exactly this idea of fracturing and fragmentation and folding and faceting of the form. That's all there. And in fact, cubism as popularized was exactly that. Tableware, these little houses, all sorts of things come up in that kind of form. Next slide. Pavel Janák in Prague, 1912, very early exponent, does something very similar with this gabled house. Next, please. Garbo, 1919, with this radio tower. Really very similar, and in fact based so very obviously on Delaunay's painting of the Eiffel Tower and making it into an actual object, a sort of direct translation from the painting back into a proposal for, though it's still two-dimensional, a real building. Next, please. And in this other example, Virgilio Marchi, a project from 1916 from a futurist with many of the same characteristics. And what you can see here is not only the loss of any sense of the ambiguity, while pushing through the program of fragmentation, is another characteristic, which is as soon as this thing, even in the model form, in the form of a maquette, turns into an actual proposal for something as heavy and unredeeming as architecture, structure takes its toll and makes the thing look unbelievably, obdurately connected to the earth and entirely without all those completely non-gravitational properties of Cubist painting. So all these are the first naive attempts at translation. Next. What I think, this is something I just caught in passing through the industrial estate in Blois. This is all you can do with an idea of the direct translation of cubism into architecture. You have to apply it in the same medium that it originally came from, and even then it becomes difficult. Next. What then we want to look at is what does happen when people who we think of as touched by this revolution in painting, what they were actually doing, what was it that enabled people like Corbusier and Mies van der Rohe to actually push this revolution and get some of these properties into architecture? Well, I think there's two interesting things here. Firstly, you can take Corbusier, who starts up painting as a serious activity, he says, in 1918. This is one of the paintings of the first few years, 1922, still life, very much part of the Cubist thing. But this is one of the it's one of Corbusier's paintings that is singled out by Timothy Hilton in his book on Picasso to try and illustrate to the reader what happens when the ideas of Picasso have the juice squeezed out of him. That's his term, the juice squeezed out of him. So there's this idea, indeed, that what the purists were doing, what Metzinger and glides and all these other attendants were doing, was sort of mechanizing the thing and making it more kind of ordinary in some way. But the particular example he chooses is Corbusier. Now, we might say that is incidental because Corbusier was actually doing something else. He was using the painting in order to get through to architecture. It's tremendously interesting that he does away with any sense of fragmentation, and the whole thing has become simply a question of overlapping elements done with some kind of grace and intelligence, but, you know, so that the nozzle of this kettle here is identical with this glass, and that this thing, which is a sound hole of that, becomes also the top of that glass, and so on. There's and this becomes, which is the back of the handle, becomes also a plan of the bottle. All these reproductions and ambiguities in that system. It's much more doctrinaire in terms of its use of the idea of orthogonal representation as well. It's being pushed ineluctably towards architecture, away from cubism, in order to get another kind of result. Next, please. I mean, that's early. Next slide. Phyllis of Wild Poissy. I don't want to talk about this because really it will take too long to make sense out of it. If you look also at Mies van der Rohe, Patrick Bauer, 1936, makes this comparison. Here's Mies van der Rohe house, here's the painting by, well-known painting by Doesburg. And this comparison is actually very much resented by Mies. He says, the Museum of Modern Art got it wrong. There was nothing of this painting in my work. What they don't understand is that architecture is very, very different to painting. Now, that seems disingenuous in some ways because the plan of this building is so... I mean, Patrick Bauer was obviously right. It is like the painting. There is a tremendous similarity. But what Mies van der Rohe was doing was suggesting that that wouldn't even matter. Next slide, please. And that if you took, for example, another building done... on a plan which is also related to this already laundered and sanitized version of cubism in de Stael, we get an actual result which is just vastly different, which has nothing to do with those things which are identifiable in the plan. The building is an immensely beautiful building, but it's not like the plan. It doesn't have the same properties, but quite different ones. And I think this is what Mies was alluding to. Next. So what I'd like to do then is to come back to add a third element to the comparison made by Gideon, which is that in order to account for this first phase of translation, all the people who actually made an effective translation between cubism and architecture did so over a very, very lengthy period of time, did so stealthily, and did so by a process of laundering the original product. So it was not a direct translation. Nothing direct occurred in it at all. And one of the least evident things in the final artifacts is fragmentation. That's been done away with completely in these buildings. There's very little evidence of it whatsoever. One can make analogies about some kind of fragmentation of space in the Villa Savoye or at the Barcelona Pavilion, but they're rather distant analogies. They're certainly not as directly exemplified as in the paintings, nothing like. Next slide, please. Oh, sorry, so I didn't say anything about that one, did I? This is a project also done by Gropius. It's the monument to the Weimar victims. It was done in 1922, and it shows all those other aspects of cubism which he chose not to push into his building. That's what's interesting about it, that he would play with them, but it would construe them in entirely sculptural terms, the fragmentation and fracturing, the dynamism and the solidity of these parts as something that belongs with this, but not with that, with the sculpture, but not with the architecture. Next. So that is that really, I think, is the period at which... this double sublimation is very evident. First, in the account of cubism itself, although it has that property to us, and then in architecture, which gets that property in any event out in its most sophisticated exemplifications. So there's no fragmentation in architecture, is the conclusion that I would draw from that in the early modern movement. So then we come to another phase where it actually does start to occur, this appearance of the thing having been broken. I talk in this analogical language all the time. And that happens, well, mostly after the war, and it happens with a kind of architecture which has as its ambition to humanize the overly mechanical and overly rational aspects of modernity as already constituted. That is that during the period of the 20s and the 30s, an idea of the international style had been developed. This had an overweening character to it, which was being identified by many writers, even in the 30s, let alone the 40s. And the ambition of this second generation of modern architects was to maintain modernity, but to modify it and humanize it from within. And one of the ways they do that is in making buildings which have this characteristic. But of course, it isn't that simple. The explanation of why that would be becomes, I think, immensely interesting and puts many other ingredients into this soup at this point. Next slide.